From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Today, a significant stride was made in the race to slow the coronavirus pandemic. Researchers at the University of Oxford say the AstraZeneca vaccine not only protects people from getting seriously sick or dying, but could also lower the rate of transmission. Their study is yet to be published, but if it is correct, it would be the first coronavirus vaccine to do both. Let's talk more about this with Dr. Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Doctor, always good to hear from you. Welcome back.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And this study has not been peer-reviewed yet, but researchers say the AstraZeneca vaccine could reduce transmission by almost two-thirds. Help us understand what that means exactly.
So what they did in this study, and this really follows up on results that they had previously published from their phase 2B clinical trial, that shows that if you swab participants in the trial every week and look to see how many of them become infected after vaccination, you will find that people who received the vaccine had far fewer cases of positive tests. So the vaccine appeared to be preventing infection in these people. They weren't becoming infected at the same rate as people in the placebo group.
Help us understand the significance of this, because the British Health Secretary called this news absolutely superb. What do you say?
I agree that it's very superb. One of the biggest questions that we have had about all of these vaccines, because of the way the clinical trials were designed, was their ability to prevent infection and thus reduce transmission in the community. The way the clinical trials were designed was to look at symptomatic COVID-19 for a couple reasons. One, that's the fastest way to evaluate whether the vaccine is actually efficacious or not. And two, one of the most important things we need a vaccine to do is keep people from getting sick and keep them out of the hospital. But that meant that we weren't able to actually look and see whether the vaccine was also protecting people from being infected. If people aren't getting infected, then they can't transmit it to others. So this suggests that not only are the vaccines very efficacious at keeping people from getting very sick, but they're also helping prevent infection altogether, which means that they're likely to reduce transmission at the population level.
Sure. So that would be great. But the issue is that AstraZeneca's vaccine is not authorized for use in the United States. Do you expect that to change soon?
Well, AstraZeneca has to actually submit an application for emergency use authorization to the FDA. I imagine that when they decide to do that, or if they decide to do that, then certainly the FDA will evaluate all of their data. I would be very surprised, based on all of the data that they've shared so far, if it didn't receive an emergency use authorization.
In a separate study, we found that Russia's vaccine, the one they've created, is called the Sputnik V, that it's about 92% effective. We don't have a lot of data on this vaccine, but it does seem, Doctor, that time and time again, we are getting really promising information that these doses are working. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think for a couple reasons. One is that vaccines work in general, and more often than not, they do generate protective immunity. That's how our immune systems work. The other thing about the Sputnik V vaccine in particular is that it is an adenovirus vectored vaccine similar to AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson. So we wouldn't expect that vaccine to behave all that differently from those other vaccines that we did get very promising data from early on. Overall, I think that there's a place in the global vaccine landscape for all of these different vaccines, because ultimately, to end this pandemic, which is by definition affecting the entire world, we're going to need to vaccinate as many people as possible globally. So having the Sputnik V vaccine enter the landscape, I think, is really great overall for global health.
Dr. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Signing three executive orders yesterday, President Biden continued to dismantle former President Donald Trump's immigration policies, creating a task force to reunite families separated at the border under Trump, and ordering a broad review of Trump's immigration practices, like making asylum seekers wait in Mexico while their paperwork is processed. All this is in addition to a broad plan Biden unveiled on his first day in office that would carve a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, among other reforms. Let's bring in Ali Nourani. He's president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum. Ali, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
We're glad to have you, and I want to start with the president's immigration bill. It aims to create a pathway to citizenship for more than 11 million immigrants who are living in the U.S. illegally, and other reforms, including some to the refugee resettlement process. That's a big proposal to put in front of such a divided Congress. So what do you see as the bill's chances? How practical is it as a day one move?
Well, I mean, I think as a day one move, it was incredibly important because, I mean, if there's anything that President Trump defined his administration on, it was being as anti-immigrant as possible. So I think it was very important for President Biden to make a clean and aggressive break with the Trump administration. And the second thing is that it set forth what the Biden vision is for immigration reform. That was often what was missing with the Obama administration. We were never quite sure, okay, where is President Obama on X, Y, and Z questions? Now, like as you ask, okay, what can actually happen in the House and Senate? Well, the thing is that, you know, immigration reform has a long history of enjoying bipartisan support. On the House side, there are two, if not three, bills passed in the last Congress that can move very quickly. That would be legislation to address Dreamers or DACA recipients, those with temporary protected status, as well as farm workers. You get those things moving, you're addressing approximately 3 to 4 million folks who are undocumented, and you're showing the country that, you know what, immigration reform is good for the American worker, good for their families, and the world just doesn't fall apart because we as the United States have said we're going to bring people out of the shadows.
You know, what I hear in your analysis there is that the president's kind of operating on parallel tracks. On the one hand, he has sort of this broader vision for immigration reform, but almost before he can do that, he's trying to just sort of get back to square one and undo some of what his predecessor did. So in the bigger picture, I mean, what structural problems do you see in our immigration system, and what would a comprehensive reform look like?
Well, I mean, how much time do we have?
Yeah, right.
I mean, look, the immigration system has not been reformed for decades. It's terribly antiquated. It's a disaster. First of all, the legalization and a past citizenship for the 11 million undocumented. And remember, there are about over 5 million undocumented workers who are part of the essential workforce today, helping us get through COVID-19. Number two, let's think about the future of legal immigration. Now, that was one thing that was missing from the Biden proposal is, you know, they didn't get into, okay, what do the future work visas look like, family visas, et cetera. And we are pegging that as a nation, we need to increase legal immigration by about 317,000 people per year in order just to maintain the old age dependency ratio. The third piece is looking at our enforcement system and putting in place enforcement measures that are actually based on risk. A border wall is not based on any sort of a risk. Securing and resourcing ports of entry, that's actually based on data because the majority of drugs, guns, and money are smuggled through ports of entry. That's what we should be fortifying. That's what we should be thinking about. And that's just one example out of many in terms of, you know, smart enforcement approaches that we need.
You know, a couple of things you just said stand out. One is the reminder that the pandemic has only made the situation more complicated. And as you say that this growth rate that you're projecting, about 317,000, there's more than that already lined up in a backlog because we suspended visa applications last April. And so now there's a backlog of more than 380,000 visa applications waiting for review. I mean, is that a starting point? There's just so much immediate work, it seems, to be done for this administration. What do you focus on first?
That's a great point. And I think the raft of executive orders that President Biden has signed over those first 2 weeks in office have been really important in a lot of different ways. But the one that he did yesterday around legal immigration, I thought was significant because, in essence, starts to chip away at that backlog of 380,000 applications. And those are changes that can be put in place within the administration without having to go through Congress.
So as you mentioned in the past, there has been some bipartisan support for reforms such as these. But it seems like this spirit of cooperation eroded in Washington in recent years. So do you think that President Biden should just sort of go all in on trying to restore that or perhaps just forge ahead on a party line vote if he needs to, perhaps by having Senate Democrats blow up the filibuster, let's say?
Well, I mean, this is the thing, I think. whether it's President Biden or Leader Schumer or Speaker Pelosi, they have more arrows in their legislative quiver at this point. And I think that there's an incredible opportunity for Democrats to engage and bring into their camp Republican voters who were just turned off by the Trump administration's approach to immigration. Or, you know, as you said, Leader Schumer can say, you know what, this filibuster thing is not allowing the country to move forward. So there are a lot of options here, but I do think that it's smart for the Democrats to begin, particularly in the Senate, to try to get to the 60 votes, because there's a history and there's a desire. And I think if they stay focused on issues like the DREAM Act and focusing on farm workers, that we'd start to make some progress.
That's Ali Noorani. He's president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum. Ali, thanks.
Thank you.
At the White House, President Biden met with Democrats this morning. He's hoping to pass his $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package with as much bipartisan support as possible. On Capitol Hill, Republicans will meet behind closed doors. They're dealing with fractures in their party after last month's deadly riot in the Capitol building. And in the rotunda, Brian Sicknick, the Capitol police officer killed in the insurrection, was honored. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi delivered remarks.
We gather today united in grief, gratitude, and solemn appreciation for the service and sacrifice of Officer Brian Sicknick.
Our political strategists join us now. Jamal Simmons is a Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. And Matt Makowiak is a Republican. Hey there, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's pick up with that deadly riot that happened a month ago today and talk about how it has changed our politics since then. Matt, you first. What do you see changed over the past month?
Well, I mean, it's a historical event. I think there are going to be lots of consequences. I think probably the first one is we're going to see, we already have seen significant security changes at the Capitol. I think that's probably here to stay. I think that's probably a good thing. On top of that, I think you're going to see obviously much more focus on rhetoric used by political figures, no matter what side of the aisle that they're on. It's one thing to ferociously debate issues, to call questions about, a candidate's character or background or experience. It's another to do what we saw when that protest, which I think was peaceful initially, then had a offshoot that went to the Capitol and committed an insurrection at the Capitol. It's totally unacceptable. I'm glad we're seeing criminal prosecutions. It was just a horrible day for the country. I think in the last 100 years, you could make an argument it was the third worst day in the last 100 years in America after Pearl Harbor and 9/11. I don't even know that we fully know all the things that are going to change over the next few years.
Well, Jamal, I mean, do you share that optimism that the rhetoric might cool? We heard similar hopes after, say, the congressional baseball game shooting, and arguably things didn't really cool down.
It just doesn't seem as if Republicans are taking this as seriously as it was. I mean, and here we are, just a month after the biggest assault in American capital since 1812. And the person who's mostly responsible for calling it to order, inspiring it, fueling it, and then stopping the Defense Department or slowing the Defense Department down from responding to it, the president, former President Donald Trump, won't be held accountable by the Republicans who were under attack by the very mob that killed this officer. So I think that I don't have confidence, not because I don't think the majority of Americans don't want justice, not because I don't think there are even Republicans. There are Republicans who do want justice. I just think the majority of the Republican conference is not interested in pushing back on these conspiracies. And we see that now even with the Marjorie Taylor Greene problem.
Well, I want to pick that up. I think the ultimate test of the former president will be the impeachment trial, which, of course, begins next week. But to today's business first, Matt, I want to start with you because I'm wondering if the Republican Party is at an inflection point because of what happened. For example, today we have these sort of meetings to discuss the fates of two prominent now Republicans. First, there's Liz Cheney, the congresswoman from Wyoming, the number three Republican in the House. She is in danger of losing her leadership position in the caucus because she voted to impeach Trump for the riot. And then meanwhile, some other Republicans want to take away Marjorie Taylor Greene's committee assignments because she supports the kind of conspiracy theories that led to that riot. So how do you think things are going to play out?
Yeah, I think it's a smart framing by you that this is an inflection point, and we can continue to go down further into the abysses of party, or we can right the ship. And look, you can strongly disagree with Liz Cheney's conclusion that impeachment was the appropriate vote. 10 members of the House conference chose to vote that way. It was a vote of conscience. Her vote didn't sway any other votes, probably. It might have provided a little bit of cover. The question is, can she remain conference chair, which is basically a communications role, having voted on a consequential vote, you know, with a very small minority of her conference? The Marjorie Taylor Greene question to me is really an easy one. I don't even understand why they haven't stripped her of her committees already, gotten ahead of this, made clear they're not going to support someone like this who said insane things, continues to say insane things, doesn't reflect the Republican Party, and isn't even conservative as far as I'm concerned. It looks like it is going to go to a House floor vote because Republicans aren't moving fast enough. And so that's a shame. It's a missed opportunity. We're going to learn some hard lessons, I think, over the next few months. We obviously are going to oppose a lot of what Biden's trying to do. We're going to call out some of these executive orders. We're not going to support, you know, a left-wing agenda. And that's all, you know, entirely appropriate. But we have got to right our ship as a party if we're going to get back to winning elections and win back the White House, win back the House in 2022, win back the Senate majority. We have to start that work now. And the longer we wait, the harder it'll be.
You know, I think one one of the things that will help Matt's point here with the Republicans that he's trying to that are trying to hold on to the Republican Party and not lose it to the QAnon group is the pro-democracy Republicans, the people who believe in the fundamental tenets of our American democracy and are willing to stand up for it. They've got to not just become an anti-Biden party. And that doesn't mean that they have to sign on everything Joe Biden wants to do. But it would be refreshing and nice to see what we saw with these Republican senators this week around the COVID plan offer conservative ideas to fix America's problems. Biden gets to set the agenda.
Yeah.
Biden gets to offer what's happening. But offer some conservative ideas, and then let's have a negotiation or even a fight about those ideas. But let's not just go automatically no to everything Biden tries to do.
I do want to get back, though, and I'm glad you jumped in there, Jamal, but I want to get both of you on this question about the sort of state of the Republican Party in the sense that, Matt, I hear you and take your point about Marjorie Taylor Greene sort of being on the fringe. I think that most of your party would not line up behind her. But we did see a Pew poll just yesterday that I thought was eye-opening. 58% of Republicans said they believe white people are going to lose influence under the Biden administration. So there is this sort of fear that white people are somehow threatened right now. What does your party do about that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think if you look at just the demographic makeup of the vote that both parties get, I mean, Democrats have often, pretty consistently relied on a larger share of the minority vote than Republicans have, and the minority vote is growing. If you look at the demographics of the country, in Texas, where I live, you know, we're a majority-minority state at this point, and Hispanics are not just the plurality. They're going to be the majority in the next 10 to 15 years. You know, as a Republican Party, I think we need to embrace that. President Trump and Republicans down ballot did great with Hispanic voters, particularly in South Texas and South Florida in November of 2020. You know, we need to embrace those communities, connect with them on cultural issues, connect with them on pro-life and hard work and strong families and those issues. So I don't like to see questions that get asked or where people think one race benefits or another race, you know, doesn't benefit. Yeah, we all have to start viewing ourselves as Americans and stop looking at all these issues through the racial lens. I think people are kind of tired of race dominating everything, every minute of every day. Race isn't the only issue. It's not that it's an insignificant issue. It's not that there are racial disparities we should try to fix. Not that it's not our original sin as Americans. But I hate to kind of frame it that way where we look at this just to the issue of race. The question is, are Americans going to benefit or not from Joe Biden's policies? Right? That's the only question that matters. And I don't think anyone
go ahead, Jamal. I just want to get you on that point, too.
Yeah, I mean, I nobody would love to get race out of the question more than black people. And I think the people who are on the receiving end of some of the trouble. But I think what we got to look at is not just the aggregate of the benefit. The problem in America isn't that we're creating enough wealth. The core problem is, how do we disaggregate that? How do we distribute the wealth? Who gets to participate in the wealth? And I think when you're looking around, you know, the CEO suite, and only 3.2% of C-suite executives are African American, I think that's the kind of thing where people say, well, maybe we need to talk about race a little bit. So, or you look at the fact that black suspects are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police officers than white suspects. Maybe we got to look at race a little bit. So I do think what is interesting in the poll, the Pew poll, is that the plurality of people think that there will be no change for whites. Even though the majority think there will be an increase of influence for blacks and Hispanics, the plurality of voters say there will be no change for whites. I think what is a little concerning is that 44% of whites, almost even, think that whites are going to lose influence. And it's that cohort, it's that group of people who are concerned, but even white Democrats and white conservatives have to talk to about what America will look like in the future when it becomes a more diverse country. White people will still have a place, and Black and Latinos and Asian Americans will grow, but white people will still have a future in this country. And that's the thing that Donald Trump has been talking about very openly and has been infuriating and inflaming this kind of sentiment. That's what people who don't believe Trump's path is the right one, they've got to come up with an alternative one.
Sure. And as we see some of those disparities, they've played out during the pandemic, of course. So I do want to ask about the COVID relief bill in the moments that we have left. And after this meeting at the White House this morning, the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said they're united on this big, bold relief package. What I'm wondering, Jamal, though, is couldn't the president sort of try to have it both ways, where he could take a deal from Republicans, and then if he needs to, he could push through other things on a party line vote through the budget reconciliation process later?
I'm all for Joe Biden negotiating with Republicans and trying to get a deal that will get to 60 Republicans getting through the filibuster, even if they all don't vote for final passage. I think that's good for the democracy. But Joe Biden should not delay getting aid to Americans as fast as possible and as much as possible if the Republicans are dilly-dallying and not being serious about closing a deal.
And Matt, just a few seconds, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, when I hear delay, I think back to Pelosi, holding up stimulus throughout the election because she thought it benefited her, knowing her bill could never get 60 votes in the Senate. It would be a good thing on an issue this important that we did get a 60-vote threshold. We have bipartisan support, and the person to watch is Joe Manchin, and he was not at the White House today, and I don't understand why he wasn't there.
Yeah, key vote there, the Democrat from West Virginia. That's Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist, and Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
If you're never quite sure how to answer the question,
where are you from?
NPR's Rough Translation might be the podcast for you.
Yes, finally, someone else.
Give us your accents and your origin stories, your cross-cultural misfits, yearning to just be, and listen to Rough Translation on NPR.
Hemp production was legalized nationwide in 2018, but the federal legislation left individual states in charge of oversight. As the crop continues to roll out across the Midwest, some states are having more success than others. Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin reports.
0.3% is hemp's magic number. That's the level of tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, that the federal government uses to distinguish hemp from marijuana. Jay Cada didn't quite make the cut.
We were the first crop in Iowa to test hot. We were more than twice the limit of THC in our plants.
He and his colleagues, who run 4M Farms in southeast Iowa, had no other choice.
We had to mow everything down and burn it.
Cada says growing hemp is hard work. Unlike row crops, most things have to be done by hand.
I have a newborn baby, so I spent all summer, instead of playing with her, I was weeding a field, and it was hot, and it was miserable. And after all that, she's like, that's cool. I'm just going to light that on fire.
Cada isn't the only one. About 13% of Iowa's hemp crop came in above the legal THC threshold. In Missouri, it was about 9%. That's largely because for many states, like Iowa and Missouri, this was the first year of legal hemp production.
Anytime you start something up, I think you have some highs and some lows and some things you didn't see coming at you.
Robin Prusner oversees the hemp program for Iowa's Department of Agriculture. She says there have been a whole host of challenges for farmers this year, including the amount of sheer manual labor.
That's like, you know, having a tomato garden that's 5 acres or however big compared to just your little kind of more typical garden in the backyard.
Producers across the Midwest also struggled with other issues, like pests and weeds, and it didn't get much easier once the hemp was harvested. Most hemp grown in the Midwest is for CBD, or cannabidiol, which is the non-psychoactive ingredient found in the cannabis plant. Extracting the CBD requires a processor, but because the industry is still so new, there's a severe lack of licensed processors across the region.
We have now licensed 364 hemp processors for what is, at this exact moment in time, an exact 800 licensed hemp growers.
David Lakeman manages the Division of Cannabis Regulation at the Illinois Department of Agriculture. He says the gap between growers and processors has narrowed slightly this year. But some farmers have figured out a workaround by acquiring their own processing licenses. Farmers like Andy Houston, who's been growing hemp in Illinois for 3 years now.
The CBD that's in our products came off of our farm. We know exactly where it's been. We know exactly how it was raised.
Because he has dual licenses, Houston can grow the hemp, extract the oil himself, and then sell infused products on site. It's a model that's worked well for him, and Houston is optimistic about hemp's future in the state.
Hemp's going to be around. I mean, it works too good not to be around.
Not only does CBD work well for relieving aches and pains, Houston says hemp also loves the Midwestern climate. David Lakeman at Illinois Department of Agriculture says, look out, corn and soybeans.
I think that within the next 5 to 10 years, hemp will be, in terms of the dollar amounts, one of the top three agricultural exports of the state of Illinois.
He says hemp's medical and industrial potential, plus the ingenuity of growers, means the crop's future is bright. For Here and Now, I'm Dana Cronin.
The pandemic is taking a toll on the political future of California Governor Gavin Newsom. His approval ratings are in a tailspin. A recent UC Berkeley poll shows his support falling from 64% this past September to just 46% now, and that's making him more vulnerable to an effort to recall him from office. KQED's senior editor for politics and government, Scott Schaefer, is here. And Scott, what's going on? Why are people so unhappy with Governor Newsom?
Well, Peter, in a word, yeah, the pandemic. You know, back in September, his approval rating was sky high, and people actually thought that Newsom's handling of the pandemic was one of his strong points. But in that poll you alluded to a moment ago, just 31% say he's done a good or excellent job. And when it comes to the vaccine rollout, 22% say he's done a good or excellent job on that, 40% saying he's done a poor job. So, you know, there's just this toxic stew of frustration, pandemic fatigue, angry businesses with these on-again, off-again, stay-at-home and closure orders, and it's taking a toll on Newsom. I will say, as we speak right now, he is announcing the opening of a couple of federal pilot projects for vaccinations in Oakland and Los Angeles. So he's trying to get ahead of it.
Well, it probably doesn't help that the coronavirus numbers in California have been sky high for quite a while now. The governor could be worried, I would imagine, because there's also this recall effort underway to remove him from office. What kind of opening do you think these numbers will give his opponents?
Well, there's definitely a lot of momentum behind collecting signatures. They've got over 1 million signatures now. They need 1.5 million verified signatures. And so there's, you know, serious money coming in behind it now. It could well qualify for the ballot. But I have to say, you know, if it's on the ballot, it could be months, at the end of the year or even into 2022 before voters vote on it. And by that time, you know, more people are going to be vaccinated. The economy could be returning to normal. Life could be returning to normal. So I think time perhaps is on Newsom's side. That poll yesterday showed that, you know, more than about half of voters say that a recall would be a bad idea, and just 36% said they'd vote for it. So, you know, Newsom's got some wiggle room, but it's a tough time for him for sure.
Interesting how this recall has evolved, because is it right that it started as almost like a fringe campaign associated with the Proud Boys?
Yeah, well, you know, there have been several recall efforts of Newsom, as there were of Jerry Brown before that, and they usually fizzle out. I think the thing that really got this one going was in November, the governor was seen at a very fancy restaurant, French Laundry, in Napa Valley, and he was eating with, you know, some friends and lobbyists. They weren't wearing masks. So here he is telling everybody to stay home, and he's out dining, you know, in a place where most people couldn't afford to pay the tip. So it just fueled a lot of anger toward him.
Well, as you say, recalls do happen in California. In 2003, Governor Gray Davis was booted from office just a few months into his second term. Do you see any similarities between then and now? Any lessons potentially learned?
Yes and no. I mean, 2003, the state was dealing with an energy crisis, rolling blackouts. We later found out Enron was sort of gaming the market. But Gray Davis was very, very deeply unpopular, much more unpopular than Newsom is now. And also you had Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, a famous movie star as an alternative. We don't have that now. Newsom's popularity is higher. And so, you know, California is also much more Democratic. That said, they have to take this recall seriously.
Well, what candidates are emerging in opposition?
Well, just yesterday, the former Republican mayor of San Diego, Kevin Faulkner, jumped in. He's a moderate Republican. He opposed Trump on a lot of his policies like anti-immigration and the border wall. But he did vote for Trump. That's going to be a liability. And then there's another San Diego Republican, John Cox, who Newsom crushed in 2018. He's in. So, you know, that's what the field looks like now. But, you know, we have to see, first of all, if the recall even qualifies for the ballot.
Yeah. You know, Scott, to me, this as an outsider, this is kind of a surprise because Governor Newsom spent the last 4 years really beating up the Trump administration. And from what I could tell, trying to brand himself as a fighter, as a progressive leader. What do you think all of this means for the state, if anything, and where it is politically speaking?
Well, it's funny because I think when Donald Trump was president, it was very easy to blame him for a lot of the problems California was facing. We sued the federal government over 100 times. Now with Trump gone, you know, there's more focus on the governor. But, you know, that said, California is still a very Democratic place. Joe Biden got 5 million more votes than Trump in 2020. Democrats have supermajorities in both houses of the legislature. And don't forget, two of the most powerful people in D.C. are from California, Speaker Pelosi and Vice President Kamala Harris. So, you know, and also, you know, Biden is looking at some of these California policies on things like climate change as a blueprint for the nation. So, you know, the national media, Peter, they love to sort of write California's political obituary every few years. and I wouldn't write us off too fast. We still got a lot going for us.
I'm not going to do that, Scott. I'm not going to write that.
Okay. I didn't say you did, but the New York Times loves you.
Sure. KQED Senior Editor for Politics and Government, Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Jeff Bezos is stepping aside as CEO of Amazon, the company he founded. In a letter to employees yesterday, Bezos made clear he's not retiring. He's moving over to become Amazon's executive chair, while the head of Amazon's cloud computing business takes over the chief executive role. It's a crucial time for Amazon, which posted huge profits in its latest quarterly earnings report yesterday, just as the Federal Trade Commission fined the company $61 million for shorting its drivers in tips. And meanwhile, Amazon workers in Alabama are looking to form the company's first union of warehouse workers in the U.S. We should note that Amazon provides financial support to NPR. Jason Del Rey is a senior correspondent for Recode, and he's been following this story. Hi, Jason.
Hi there.
So we understand Bezos will probably still have major sway over the company. And, you know, what do you make then of him giving up this top title? I mean, he's just decided that it's time to move on. He's only 57, but maybe building a $1.7 trillion company is tiring.
I think, you know, things were trending this way for a couple of years now. Bezos has been spending more time on a whole slew of other initiatives. His rocket company, Blue Origin, he owns the Washington Post, as you know, we know. He now has this climate pledge, trying to get other companies to join Amazon in climate initiatives, and the Day One Fund, which is sort of a big philanthropy fund. So things were trending this direction. You know, the pandemic hit. Bezos got a little more involved in the day to day as Amazon, like many companies and the rest of the world, were dealing with unprecedented challenges. But, you know, the general timing, not too much of a surprise. And as you put it, he'll still be involved in sort of new and exciting early projects from the executive chairman role.
I see. But the day-to-day goes to Andy Jassy. Could you help introduce us to him, Jason? And it seems notable that this is an elevation of somebody from the Amazon Web Services division and not the core retail business. Does that indicate something about the future of the company?
You know, I think so. Andy Jassy joined the company in 1997. He's been there a very long time. His background is he has an MBA, so he's a business mind. He started as a marketing manager on the retail business. But yes, he helped invent and then run Amazon Web Services, which invented the entire cloud computing industry in the business world. So he's been running sort of a pure tech company inside of Amazon, which is, yes, different than the retail business. But he also has that early history on the retail side. He comes from a business background. So Amazon likes to think of itself as an invention company. And I think the fact that Jassy was an early inventor of one of Amazon's most successful businesses outside of its core retail business was one of the key reasons Bezos tapped him to lead the company going forward.
And what exactly is he inheriting in your view, Jason? Because on the one hand, we have that massive quarterly earnings report that we just mentioned. There's also that FTC fine and some unionization efforts. So is this just a stay the course kind of job, or does he have some real challenges on his hands?
No, I just published a piece, just a few minutes ago that sort of, looks at who he is, but also the immense scrutiny and challenges that he's walking into. He faced some of these already in, leading AWS. They have a facial recognition software, which police were using that came under fire for, accusations that it was, biased against certain races. AWS has other contracts with government agencies like ICE that people inside and outside the company were upset with. So he has dealt with scrutiny on some level. But yes, it's an all different ballgame at the top. Antitrust concerns, labor battle.
Sure.
And, some people have speculated that Bezos maybe just, he testified last year in front of the Congress for the first time. And maybe he just, didn't want to face this anymore. And so, yes.
Sure.
He has a lot.
Jason Del Rey from Recode, we're going to have to leave it there. Sorry to cut you off. You're listening to Here and Now.
The ocean's top predators are in decline. A new study published by an international team of scientists in the journal Nature found the population of many sharks and rays has plunged more than 70% since 1970. Sonia Fordham is a co-author of that study. She's also president of the group Shark Advocates International, a project of the Ocean Foundation. Sonia, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. Those numbers are astounding, and the problem has been ongoing for years. Your study says that in the early 2000s, up to 273 million sharks were killed every year. What's been happening to these animals?
Well, we've seen over the last 50 years a pretty dramatic increase in fishing pressure that coincided with a growing international market for shark meat and fins and even the gill plates of species like manta rays. And really lax or non-existent limits on fishing. And this is a problem we see for a lot of fish species, but it's often can be much more acute for sharks and rays because they tend to grow very slowly and their populations can be easily depleted and then take a really long time to come back.
Can you explain where this fishing is happening and what it looks like? Because I was under the impression that shark fishing is actually banned in many parts of the world.
The protections for sharks and rays around the world really vary quite a bit. So very few countries comprehensively manage their shark fisheries. The U.S. would be one of those. Other countries have completely banned shark fishing. But overall, most countries don't set basic limits on how many sharks and rays can be landed. And for these wide-ranging species, it's really important to have international cooperation because the populations are being fished by many countries.
So what is the consequence of all that fishing? You looked at 31 species of sharks and rays and found that 3/4 of them were threatened with extinction. What would it mean to lose them?
Well, just the depletion and certainly the loss of shark and ray populations, it jeopardizes the health of ocean ecosystems. So many of these species are important predators. And it also harms food security in a lot of developing nations and squanders opportunities that we might have for sustainable ecotourism around the world with some of the most charismatic of these species.
Hmm. Is there an effort underway in places like China, for instance, to talk about the impacts of their demand for dishes like shark fin soup?
Actually, there's been a lot of attention to shark fin soup and the problems of shark finning, and a lot of groups have made progress through both regulation but also consumer information. We do still see demand for shark meat on the rise. Sharks and rays are used for all kinds of purposes, for sport fishing in some places, and every country can do better.
Yeah. What about climate change? What kind of impact is that having?
We're just starting to see some results from studies. I would say certainly climate change is going to have some negative implications, but those are coming on the horizon, and overfishing is here right now, has been here for decades.
We do see that there are a few bright spots. The white shark population and the hammerhead shark are both rebounding. Do their stories have anything to teach us?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we're trying to highlight the few success stories because they do have important lessons. And we talk about the white shark and the hammerhead off the U.S. coast in particular. They're not doing better everywhere, certainly not hammerheads. They're globally endangered species. But the white sharks off both coasts of the U.S., we've seen their retention was banned in the 1990s. There are other factors in the U.S. helping white sharks, primarily protection of their marine mammal prey. But we have seen rebounding populations off both coasts. That's very encouraging. One of the simple lessons is that relatively basic safeguards that aren't always perfectly implemented can really help save sharks and rays.
You know, you are a shark advocate. It's your job to help people understand why they're important, but that can be a pretty tough job with an animal like a shark, can it? How do you get over the fact that most people are terrified of these things? They don't really care, you know?
Yeah, well, sharks, let's say negative public image certainly has been a factor. It's people being misinformed about the threats that sharks present to people. But it's also can be a general perception of sharks as pests or threats to other species. You know, either people don't like them or they just don't want them around. And also that they're generally less valuable than more traditional food fish like tuna or swordfish or cod. So they end up having a low research and conservation priority, which has led to this situation.
Sonia Fordham, president of Shark Advocates International and co-author of a new study in the journal Nature that found the population of sharks and rays in the ocean has fallen 70% in the past 50 years. Sonia, very sobering. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.